Wunderschönen guten Morgen.
Bevor George loslegt
mit History of English, sage ich ganz kurz was zu uns. Wir sind vom Kim Lecture Recording Streaming Service hier an der Universität Konstanz. Wir dürfen die Vorlesung auch wieder aufzeichnen. Das bedeutet für euch nicht, dass ihr nur noch heute kommt und beim nächsten Mal nicht mehr, sondern es ist eher so gedacht, dass das nochmal unterstützend funktioniert. Im Endeffekt auch so ein paar Sachen wiederholen, einfach auch um die Veranstaltung ein bisschen zu öffnen für Leute, die dann doch vielleicht mal nicht kommen können oder die sagen, ich möchte mich gerne in einem Bereich ein bisschen mehr einarbeiten. Dazu gibt es dann dieses Lecture Recording. Zum Ablauf ist es so, dass wir das normalerweise heute aufzeichnen und dann schauen, dass wir es innerhalb von 48 Stunden auch online zur Verfügung stellen. Das ist so unser Ziel, das gelingt uns eigentlich auch immer meistens. Für euch ganz wichtig zu wissen ist, dass wir nur George aufzeichnen hier, wenn man ihn dann auch sieht. Ein bisschen Licht noch, dann wäre es glaube ich besser. Die Präsentation selber zeichnen wir auch mit auf, aber ihr selber seid nicht im Bild, also sprich die Kamera filmt wirklich nur George. Es ist auch so, dass ihr natürlich währenddessen Fragen stellen dürft. Es ist dann auch so, dass wir die Fragen im Nachhinein rausschneiden werden. Das heißt, ihr werdet auch nicht zu hören sein. George aber darf die Frage gerne auch wiederholen und dann auch beantworten, sodass auch ein Kontext hergestellt werden kann während der Aufzeichnung, wenn man es dann wiederum anschaut oder wiederholt. Und ja, das sind so die Hauptbedenken, glaube ich. Ansonsten, ja, die Kollegin oben macht das jetzt das ganze Semester. Ich hoffe mal, dass sie das gut hinbekommt, aber ich bin mir da sicher, sie ist routiniert. Wenn ihr Fragen habt, dürft ihr jetzt mich fragen. Habt ihr irgendwelche Fragen zum Aufzeichnen allgemein? Nein? Ansonsten, wenn ihr welche Fragen habt, dann meldet euch gerne. Die Streams sind verfügbar über die Universitätsseite. Wenn ihr eingibt Kim und dann Streaming uni-konstanz.de, dann könnt ihr dort die ganzen Vorlesungen auch online abrufen. So, kurz und knapp. Ich wünsche euch ein schönes Semester und alles Gute.
Okay, so welcome and it's a very auspicious day to start learning about the history of English, because it is English Language Day. If you go on the internet, you will find lots of English language related things. It is the day on which William Shakespeare died. It's also the day on which his birthday is traditionally celebrated. That's probably a factual confusion, but never mind. The important thing is it's English Language Day. And so it's worth asking questions, the kind of questions like, where did this language come from? This stupid language that we all have to learn in school and that seems to be everywhere around the globe, in the media. Where did this language come from? How did it start out? How did it get to where it is today? And those are the kind of questions we're going to be addressing in this course. So we're going to go backwards. I'm just going to give you a small taster of the early history of the English language. Traditionally, we divide the language up into periods. I'll talk more about this later. Modern English from 1700 onwards, early modern English from 1500, middle English from about 1150, and old English before that. Let's have a look at these language stages now. So here we have some modern English. Hopefully, you can understand what this says. If not, you might have difficulty with this lecture in general, or indeed with studying English at the university, and might want to go back to school and brush up a little bit, right? But hopefully you can figure out what this says. This is a passage from the Bible, and I've chosen the Bible simply because it's a text that we have lots of different versions of going all the way back into the history of the language, so we can compare very directly. We've got a farmer went out to sow his seed. As he was scattering the seed, some fell along the path, and the birds came and ate it up. This is from 1973, so not all that long ago in the grand scheme of things. Before most of us were born, but still not all that long ago. Here we've got an early modern English version of the text. So here, if we go back 350 years, we get to the King James Version. Now this King James Version of the Bible is still quite widespread today, you can kind of see why, because it has a certain gravitas to it. It's roughly contemporary with Shakespeare. And when we look at this text, we mostly, hopefully, can understand, right? It's not that hard. It does start with, behold, which is not something that you typically hear in English discourse these days. I am always tempted to start my lectures with, behold! Maybe I would do that if it were 8:15 in the morning, because then you would need waking up. But I take it that you're all awake and listening, right? If you're asleep, please raise your hand. No, okay, good. Coffee helps. So here we've got behold, we've got went forth. Again, this is not exactly ruled out in present-day English, but it does have this rather archaic ring to it. Similarly with devoured. We've got this word for the birds. We're talking about these specific birds. They are fowls, right? And this also isn't a word that one typically hears spoken, though there are words, there are phrases and words that include it. So, for instance, waterfowl, we sometimes talk about when we're referring to ducks and geese, that we can call them waterfowl. Interestingly, this fowl word is related to German Vogel very closely. If you think about them, they actually sound more or less the same. And the further you go back in the history, the more English and German converge. This will be one of the themes of the course. I don't want to jump ahead of myself too much, but we'll get there. Okay, but this is early modern English, and the point I wanted to make is this doesn't really pose a comprehension problem. Here we've got the Middle English version, and you might think this is a little bit more of a challenge. So once again, we've gone back. This time we've only gone back 200, just over 200 years from the King James Bible. Here we've got Wycliffe's version of the Bible. Now Wycliffe was an interesting character because, first of all, he was translating the Bible into English in the 14th century. And at that time, that was a very controversial thing to be doing. And in fact, that led to a lot of negative consequences. Not so much for him, because he died before the shit could really hit the fan, as they say. After his death, he was declared to be a heretic. He was declared to be a heretic by the Concil in some small town called Konstanz. After that, this Bible, or in fact not this Bible, but the writings of Wycliffe in general, influenced Jan Hus, who, and we all know what happened to him. It really didn't end well for him. This is a sort of a Bible with a slightly interesting political history, but what's interesting about it from our perspective is that actually you now know more or less what it's supposed to say, but it looks a little bit interesting, shall we say. So again, we've got this rather archaic lo beginning the utterance, and then we've got some interesting endings that are highlighted in blue. So we've got he that soweth, and then we've got sowe on the infinitive, to sowe his seed. Some seeds fell beside the way, but fell den, right? There's a special ending here. We've also got some other rather odd things, like for bird, we've got brid here. For the pronoun, we would expect in the modern language them, we've got instead hem. Now, these pronouns have a very interesting history that we'll come back to later on in the course. And we've also got this weird verb, jede, which is went, in the first line. This, you know, it's hopefully still on the border of comprehensibility. If you didn't know what it said, you might be challenged, but it's not completely insane. If you want completely insane, let's go back another 400 years, and here we've got some old English. So this says, Zodlice ut eoda sesadere, his sad to sawen, on thatha heseoth, summa he fell on with way, on foglas komun und atantha. This, I think, nicht erschrecken, okay? This is Old English. This, I should emphasize right now, you are not going to be expected after this course to be able to fluently read and translate this kind of thing, right? There is no way that we could get you up to that level in a course like this. If you're interested in that, and it is pretty cool, you can study further, and there's a seminar that you can take later on. But, you know, even the people who've taken that seminar mostly still can't fluently read and translate this kind of language, right? It's hard. And it's how dramatically different it is from the Middle English we just saw is actually one of the striking facts about the history of English. Why is there this discontinuity? I mean, okay, we've gone back 400 years, but even so, hardly any of the words are really recognizable at first glance. You have to really think about it. So actually, we got ut as a second word, which means out, and we've got, you might be able to recognize something like sædere and sed. This is seed, the word for a seed, and the sædere is just the seeder, the person who sows the seeds. And here again, we've got this beautiful word, fuglas, the birds. But this language is a whole other thing, right? We've really got to something here that is very, very different from anything that we've seen before. This is the West Saxon Gospels, by the way. This is the earliest translation of the Gospels into English. So we can't go back any further than this. Before that, there were no English Bibles. And you can see, in fact, here I've given you on the slide a slight hint as to what this looks like in the original text. So this is a manuscript. This is a manuscript that you can find in the Parker Library of the Corpus Christi College, Cambridge. And this is what this looks like when it's written down. A beautiful English manuscript. So this is just to give you a flavour, and we've gone back in time to the origins, to the earliest point in the English language. And this course will be covering all of this, but we'll actually be covering it in the opposite order. So far, we've gone back in time, we've talked from modern English, gone back to old English. For the rest of the course, we're going to be very slowly coming back towards the present day. So we'll be starting, in fact, with the prehistory, we move on to talking about the Old English period, and then the Middle English period, and then the early modern English period, finally bringing us up to the present day. Okay? So here is the practical stuff that you need to know about this course. If you're watching this online as a general interest person, you can skip over this section. So we're going to cover the whole history of the English language. This is what I said. We're going to start out with the ancestors of English, back when there was no English language to speak of, right? But all languages come from somewhere, and English is no exception. So we'll be talking about the ancestors of English in the as far back as it's possible to go. That's the subject next week. We'll be talking about different types of change that have affected the English language, because obviously, from what we've just seen, this language has changed hugely. So how and why? Well, we can, at a first pass, talk about internal changes, changes that a language just happens to go through on its own, and external changes that are galvanized, that are catalyzed by something like language contact, when other languages enter the picture as well. And we'll see that in the history of English, that is quite a big topic. We'll be dealing with every period of the language up to the present day, though we'll be giving more attention, obviously, to the earlier periods, both because they're harder, but also because they will not be covered in the majority of other courses that you do, which will deal with the present day language. And the aim is to, first of all, sort of help to assuage your curiosity about the history of the English language, because hopefully some of you are at least a little bit curious what was going on with the history, with the origins, with how this gigantic language, this sort of monstrous beast of a language, managed to get the way it is today. Also, it will give you some sort of familiarity with those early varieties, the changes that they underwent, and also you will have some idea of how to read them, or at least how to work with these texts. And those are some of the things that we will be doing on this course together. In terms of textbook for this course, you should get a copy. Ideally, you should buy a copy. The textbook looks like this. So this is Elie van Gelderen's book, A History of the English Language. If you don't have one of these, you ought to be able to pick one up downstairs in the campus Oceander. If they don't have any, they can order one in for you, or you can get it online or whatever. This one, if you look very, very closely, you'll see it says revised edition in the bottom right-hand corner. That's not strictly necessary for your purposes. If you buy a new copy, it's better to get the revised edition, but it doesn't matter if you can only get your hands on the earlier 2006 edition. And there's also a companion website that you can use if you want to find out more, if you want to follow things up. So that's so I've talked about what I'm offering, what we're offering on this course. Here's a little bit about what I'm expecting from you. So I'm going to take it that you've mostly done SHE1, the prerequisite course, and I'm going to assume the following bits of SHE1 in particular. First of all, phonetics. So you should have some idea of what the International Phonetic Alphabet is and how to use it. That's important because we can't assume that earlier stages of English spelling corresponded to the same sounds that it does today. You will need to be able to read these kind of international phonetic alphabet representations. I'm also going to assume that you know what basic parts of speech are, nouns, verbs, adjectives, prepositions, that kind of thing. I'm going to assume that you know what cases are as well. So I'm going to assume that you know, if I talk about accusative, genitive, dative, that you will have some clue about what I'm talking about. And syntax, in terms of syntax, I'm going to assume only the basics, but I will assume that you know what things like subject and object are, and that you're able to talk about word order in basic terms. If you want a refresher on any of this stuff, chapter 2 of the textbook contains a few useful bits and pieces, or you can always go back to your SHE1 lecture notes and have another look. I am in G116, which is right down at the bottom end of the G building, the furthest possible point on the end. You can come and see me there. You can come and see me within my Sprechstunden, and they are open, so you just turn up. Those are Mondays 3 till 4 and Wednesdays 11:30 till 12:30. If you want to see me outside those times, you should email me to make an appointment. The lectures, you've all made it. You've all passed the first test, which is to find where the lecture takes place. This isn't so difficult for this one, given that it's the biggest lecture hall in the university. But you're all here, which is good. It's Mondays 10 till 11:30. I'm going to make the slides available 24 hours before the lecture every time. So if you want to take a printed copy with you to bring to the lecture, if that's your favourite way of making notes, you're more than welcome to do that by just printing off what I put on the Ilias page. The lectures will also be recorded, as you've heard. We've got the Kim streaming service on the job. And that has various practical advantages. So for a start, it means that you shouldn't bust a gut trying to make precise notes about every single thing that I say. You can always go, if it works, which it should, fingers crossed, we did this last year and it worked perfectly, so hopefully it will work again. You can always go onto the streaming server and rewind and play things back, and you can play things back fast so that I have a really high-pitched voice, or really slowly so that I have a kind of slow, rather droning voice. And either way, whatever floats your boat, you can take this lecture, you can go and listen to it on the beach, you can listen to it in the bath, you can listen to it while you're cooking a meal. I will be your constant companion through your daily activities. This is, like I said, don't worry about the streaming. If you ask a question, no one will hear it other than me, because I'm the one with the microphone. I might repeat or rephrase your question. Please feel free to ask. Right. The only stupid question is the question that you didn't ask. Actually, I say that, but there are many, many really stupid questions. Right. But the thing is, if you have a question in your head that's buzzing, chances are that at least half a dozen other people in the room will have exactly the same question. So it won't just be you. You might as well ask, because it's probably just confusing and you probably just want the answer. So please do speak up, and I will try and respond. So that's the lecture side of the course. We've also got tutorials, and you can choose your tutorial time. As you can see, we've got 5 different tutorial slots. These tutorial slots cover the whole range of the schedule. So if you're the kind of person that likes to get up stupidly early in the morning, you can go to an 8:15 tutorial. If you're the kind of person that likes to work stupidly late in the evening, you can go to a 6:45 tutorial or a 5 p.m. tutorial. And if you're the kind of person that likes to do your work after lunch when you're in a food coma, you can go and do the 13:30 tutorial on Tuesdays. So hopefully there will be something for everyone. And the tutors will be delivered by our wonderful tutor team in the front row. Could you stand up, please, and wave? Yes, good. So we have Thomas, we have Christoph, we have Jens, and we have Stephanie. And they will be available to answer your stupid questions as well as your sensible ones, right? If you have a really stupid question, send it to these guys rather than me, please. You know, I can deal with sensible questions, but you know, I have only a moderate tolerance for stupid questions. But the part that you would all be asking about if I didn't tell you about it now would be, how is the assessment done? How does this work, right? How do you get credits for this course? That part is very simple. It's a multiple choice exam. And the multiple choice exam takes place in the lecture slot for week 14. So make sure you put that in your calendar now. Week 14, you will need to be here, you will need to sit here and do the exam. And that is how you get your credits for this course. If you go online, if you go on ILIAS, you can see a sample exam, which gives you a rough idea of what the exam is going to look like that you will be doing at the end of the semester. Though, I will tell you right now, the questions will not be exactly the same as the one on the sample exam. This is the syllabus. We've got a few gaps, as you can see. So we're starting today in the week two of the semester on the English Language Day. Next week, we're going to talk about the pre-Old English period, the ancient history of English. The 2 weeks following that, we're going to talk about Old English. Then we'll have a little bit of a break. So first of all, we have a week off because it's Pfingst that you can do with as you will. And the week after that is reading week. So you should go away and do some reading. After that, we'll move on to Middle English. So we'll cover the transition from Old to Middle English in week 8. We'll cover the Middle English period itself in weeks 9 and 10. 11 is Early Modern English. 12, we'll cover the transition to the present day. And then in 13, we'll have a wrap-up lecture that will hopefully help prepare you for the exam and remind you of the key themes, the key pieces of information that you will need to know. And I probably don't need to remind you, if you are on the either the Lehramt or the B.Ed programs, you will need to do an oral exam at the end of your course, and you will get asked about historical stuff, right? You just will. So some of this information, at least, you will need to retain for at least the next few years, in principle. That is the first part. Today, I am going to cover two more things in detail. I'm going to cover the origins, the historical origins. We're not going to do any more work with the language per se today. I'm going to talk a bit about the historical background, and then I'm going to talk a bit about why studying the history of English is a good thing in the first place. Because hopefully some of you are convinced already, but in case you're not, let's see if we can change that. But first of all, are there any burning questions about the practicalities of the course? Is there anything that I didn't make clear? All right, brilliant. We shall move on. When we look at, we have to zoom in now on the British Isles. That's what this slide is supposed to represent. And I can tell you right now, most of this course is going to be about the British Isles. And actually, that shouldn't go without saying. English today is by no means the property of the Queen, right? It's by no means something that's restricted to the British Isles. English is everywhere. English is in many, many countries that speak it as a native language, many countries that speak it as an official language, even where it's not a native language. You can't get away from English in the present day and age. But when we focus on the history of the language, we focus mainly on the British Isles. And there are two reasons for that. One of them is trivial and one of them is sensible, right? One of them is that I am British myself and I like the British Isles, and that's one of the reasons we're going to focus on the British Isles. The other reason, and this is the serious reason, is that the British Isles are where all the action happened. So up until about 1500, it doesn't make any sense to talk about English anywhere else because there really was none. And so that's why the focus is going to be on Britain, and that's why for the rest of today, what I'll be telling you about is the prehistory of the British Isles. So long, long, long before there was an English language, long before anyone speaking anything that could be conceived of as English, there were people in the British Isles. I'm not sure whether people is necessarily the right term. Hominids, certainly. They were relatives of ours in the biological sense, at least. And the excavations from Box Grove show you these people, what some vague snippets into their life and their physical being. So here we have a tibia, a bone from one of these ancient hominids found in the British Isles. These guys are really old. We're talking 500,000 years ago, half a million years ago, pre-Ice Age. Really, the only message here is that hominids have been on the British Isles since the year dot. These guys, however, the hominids that you see who had bones like this one, almost certainly didn't have language, right? Anything. Not only didn't they have English, they also didn't have any kind of language that we would regard as a modern human language. After the Ice Age, during the Ice Age, Britain became a fairly miserable place to live. It's still a fairly miserable place to live, but not as miserable as it was then. About 10,000 years ago, we get humans coming back. They start to reoccupy Britain. And about 5,000 years ago, they construct this thing, Stonehenge, one of the ancient monuments of the British Isles. These guys left a trace, and here we're getting a lot closer to the present day. Now we've just skipped over 500,000 years of the history of the British Isles in one slide, but hey, right? We're going to focus a lot more narrowly on the most recent 2,000 years, right? Particularly the most recent 1,500. So what happens next? You've got humans in the British Isles. We don't know much about them because they weren't writing things down. They almost certainly weren't writing things down. At the very least, if they were, those records haven't survived. 3,000 years or so ago, we have the arrival in the British Isles of a people called the Celts. Now, the Celts would have spoken a language that, as we will see next week, is related to English, but it is by no means English, and it is by no means a Germanic language. This is a different kind of language, a Celtic language, and these Celts migrated from Europe to Britain, to the whole of the British Isles, and in fact the name Britain, the name of the British itself, probably comes from the name of one of these tribes. You can still find Celtic languages today in the present. Mostly they've survived in the most northerly and westerly parts of the British Isles. So if you go to Wales, you will hear people speaking Welsh, or at least if you go to certain parts of Wales. In Scotland, you can hear people speaking, or Scotland or Ireland, you can hear people speaking different varieties of Gaelic or Gaelic. And these languages live alongside English to the present day in an interesting situation of multilingualism. But by this point, there were no Anglo-Saxons on the scene. When we get to roughly 2,000 years ago, we have the Roman Empire arriving in Britain. And in the early parts of the Common Era, so the first century AD, we have the Roman Empire making very serious inroads into Britain. Now, obviously, the Romans were not just in Britain. The Romans were all over the place. They had a lot of things that they liked to get out of Britain, particularly for mining purposes. There was lead, there was copper, and the Romans came here for that. And they brought with them their Roman things, like Roman legions, Roman buildings, Roman roads, right? Long, straight roads. And at this point, the Celts came into contact with people who would have been speaking a different language, a version of Latin. But we still have no Anglo-Saxons, no English speakers on the scene at all. What we have is a situation where the Celts are in contact with the Romans. The Romans never rule all of the British Isles. The northernmost limit of the Roman rule was what you see pictured on the slide here, Hadrian's Wall, which roughly, very roughly, demarcated the edge of the Roman Empire, the northwestern limit of that empire. In the early days, we still need the main piece of the picture, right? We still need people who speak something that we can call English. And that happens in the 5th century. So here's the traditional story. The traditional story is told by Bede. Bede, also known as the Venerable Bede, one of the very few people in the early days of England who bothered to write anything down about the historical situation. He is, although he is venerable, we can't always trust him. He had his own biases, he had his own interests, just like anyone who's writing about history, just like anyone who's talking about history. So make sure you don't trust Bede too much. Make sure you don't trust me too much. But at least I have, if I'm not sure about something, I can Google it, right? Bede couldn't do that, right? Believe it or not, when Bede was writing in the first millennium AD, there was no Google. So he has to rely on some very dubious sources. And so when we talk about what Bede said, we have to take it with a pinch of salt. Nevertheless, I'm going to tell you Bede's story, first of all because it's a cool story, but also because we don't have anything else to tell, right? This is the historical record that we have, and whether we believe it or not is up to us. Having said that, 449 AD, we've got a Celtic king, Vortigern. Vortigern is a king, a British king, in the narrow sense, right? If you can see, on the slide here, British is what's spoken in what's present-day England and Wales, British Celtic. The British, as Celts, were under a certain amount of pressure, because there were other Celts, the Irish and the Picts, who were putting pressure on them militarily. So in the land of the Celts, there was some war going on. And Vortigern decides that he wants an advantage. And the advantage that he tries to get is from the continent. He tries to look to northern Germany and Denmark, or what is now northern Germany and Denmark. It's always important to bear in mind that these political entities that we talk about, the modern nation states, are very, very much newer, very much younger than the physical reality or even the peoples that inhabited those areas. But what these areas, they contained peoples that we that were at the time at least called Angles, they were called Saxons, they were called Frisians, and they were called Jutes. The Frisians are mostly still there. The Angles and the Jutes are a little bit trickier to identify, but they were somewhere in this area, and they would have been speaking a Germanic variety. Why did Vortigern want to talk to these guys? Well, he wanted to make a deal with them. He wanted to make a deal that said, you come over and help us out, and we will pay you a lot of money, basically. We will make it worth your while to come to Britain and help us out against the Picts and the Irish. And this didn't end up working for very long, because what happens is that these Saxons, these Anglo-Saxons, the Angles, the Saxons, the Frisians, the Jutes, we conventionally call them Anglo-Saxons, but whether that would have meant anything to them is less clear, and everything about the tribal identities is pretty unclear. Either way, we have these Anglo-Saxons arriving. They were led by two Saxons, one called Hengist or Hengist, and one called Horsa. And these guys ultimately end up orchestrating a kind of revolution, if Bede is to be believed, that leads to the Anglo-Saxons getting power in the British Isles. Now, again, you might want to be skeptical. And one reason to be skeptical is looking at the names of these two guys. So if you look at the names of these two characters, you might already be a little bit suspicious. Hengist, right? In modern German, you have a word which is very closely related to this, Hengst. So this guy is called Hengst. And the other guy is called Horsa, which is a bit, which is related to German Ross, English horse. So these two guys are called basically like male horse and horse. This is not exactly the material of a credible narrative, but beyond that, we can actually see in various mythological traditions of the Indo-European peoples, and we'll talk more about Indo-Europeans next time. We can see this these sort of holy brothers. As a sort of favoured origin myth, horse-related brothers. This we also see, for instance, in Sanskrit texts, right? So this mythology of the founding brothers who were something horse-related. Regardless, like I say, you might want to be sceptical here, but this is something like this must have happened, right? At some stage, some Germanic people came to the British Isles. And that was really where it all started. So that is why we use 449 as a sort of as a bookend. It's very convenient when we are trying to build a periodization of the English language. This we've touched upon already. So I've said we're going to cover these different periods. It's important to interrogate these periods and ask what they mean and ask what they represent. And in fact, the periodization is usually based on a combination of linguistic facts, so what is actually happening in the language, how is it changing, and also historical facts, so what is happening to the English language, what is happening to England, to Britain, during the period. Old English, we call the period from 450 to 1150. So 449 is when the Germanic tribes arrive, according to Bede. We round to the nearest 10 or the nearest 50, because that's what historical people like to do. They're a big fan of round numbers. The Old English period lasts up until 1150. Then we get a transition into the Middle English period, because around 1150 we start to get more modern-looking texts, like the Peterborough Chronicle, which is something that you'll get to look at in the tutorials later on in the course. So that's when the Middle English period starts. This also, there is also, to a certain extent, a break in the textual transmission at this point, and we'll come back to this when we talk about this transitional period later in the course.
At around 1500, we see that the great vowel shift is underway and that printing has been innovated. Both of these things happen, and that leads to 1500 being taken as our nice round number for saying this is when the early modern English period begins. And from 1700 to the present day, we usually refer to this time as the modern English period. There are a few key dates around this point. The restoration of the British monarchy in 1660, there's a whole other story there. The monarchy got rid of, and then they brought it back. And then later on, 1776, you get the US Declaration of Independence, which marks indubitably that English has spread by this point. There is no point in saying that at the end of the 18th century, English is the property of the British Isles specifically. But it's important to remember that all of these periodizations are arbitrary. They have reality to us as historians of the language. They would not have had any reality to people of the time. So it's not as if on the 1st of January 1500, everyone woke up and said, woohoo, we're now speaking early modern English, right? We're going to get rid of all of those Middle English habits that we had before and suddenly switch to speaking completely differently. It didn't happen like that. Nothing in language changes overnight. Some things change fast, some things change more slowly. Overnight, no, right? So these periodizations are just based on nice round numbers. So to a certain extent, arbitrary. So that's just to set the scene historically. And what we're going to do next time is to come back to how this works linguistically, how these languages relate to one another, Celtic, Latin, Germanic, Indo-European, Anglo-Saxon, Frisian, Jutish, Anglian, Saxon. What do all these terms mean? This is what we will do next time round. But for now, I want to touch on something that I think is kind of more fundamental, which is why are we here? Well, there are several reasons you might be here. One of the reasons is that this course is compulsory, so you don't exactly have much choice in the matter. And for those of you who really would rather not be here and who I can never persuade to be a lover of the history of the language, I'm very sorry, but you will have to put up with me for at least another 13 weeks. Hopefully, at least some of you are interested already, and that's another good reason to be here. And hopefully, at least, I will be able to convince some more of you that this is something that's worth studying. Because some of the things that we see in the English language really only makes sense when we study them from a historical perspective. So let's take the word fish, right? The aqueous creature with gills and a little tail that you can hook out of the Bodensee if you are that way inclined. Well, it's sometimes been observed that in principle, in terms of how the sound maps onto the spelling in English, this word fish could equally well be spelled G-H-O-T-I. How does that work? Well, if we take the sound in a word like enough or cough, right, GH represents f. So we have GH standing in for f. In a word like women, the letter O stands for an I, like the I in fish. As for the TI, in a word like nation, or any word that ends in Asian, of which there are many, this sh is spelt TI. So if we just take the way that these words are mapped onto the sounds, there's no real reason that the word fish couldn't be spelled like this. I mean, I don't know about you, but this seems to me to be completely insane. And why a language would choose to do this is, it's a mystery maybe. Why would a language have weird spelling like this? We can answer this kind of question, or at least we can partially answer it, by looking at the history of the language, looking at what happened in the language's development. And the short answer to this question, which we will dwell on in much more detail when we come to the early modern English part of the course, is that English spelling was standardized before certain major sound changes happen. What do I mean by standardized? Well, as linguists, we can distinguish between different varieties of a language, and we can distinguish between varieties on various different dimensions: region, social class, register. All of these work as the basis for distinguishing the way people speak, the way people use language. In Germany, people from Swabia don't speak the same way as people from Berlin, necessarily. And it's exactly the same, of course, in the English-speaking world. People from London don't speak the same way as people from Edinburgh. People from London also don't speak the same way as people from Manchester or other cities, and people from London or Edinburgh or Manchester definitely don't speak the same way as someone in New York or Chicago or Adelaide or Toronto or anywhere else in the English-speaking world. All of these geographical locations have their own varieties of English. And if you want to study more about that, you can take the aptly named course Varieties of English at some stage later in your academic career. We also have language variation by social class. People who are rich and wealthy and very highly regarded in society tend to speak differently. And we also have variation according to register. So if you're speaking to your family and your friends, you might not necessarily speak the same way as you would if you're in an interview situation and you have to use your most proper language. And all of these are pretty much universals of human language. One thing that we know about human language is that it varies over time and over space and over different dimensions of what it means to be human. We also get varieties that are specific, for instance, to a certain gender or specific to a certain ethnic grouping as socially constructed. Variation is ubiquitous. The standard language, and this is important, the standard language is just one variety. It's actually the variety of a specific social or regional group. And this also is more or less the same anywhere. What you find is that when you look at where the standard language came from, when you look at who spoke it when it was originally standardized, you find that they were the people with the influence, they were the people with the power. So it's no accident that the standard language of France is heavily influenced from Paris. It's no accident that the standard language in England is heavily influenced by London. Right. Political and social power always goes with the right to, or the right in inverted commas, because it's not really a right, to pick your language. And then ultimately to decide that that language is better than everyone else's. And this is something, again, that we see over and over again. This stuff's important for you because some of you, a lot of you, are going to become teachers. And when you do that, you will be tasked with speaking English, teaching English to your students. And you're going to have to make a choice because you can't just teach English, right? English is not one thing. There are many, many different Englishes all around the world of various different statuses, with various different linguistic features. This whole thing, if you put it together, is often referred to as an English language complex. So English is complex. There are all kinds of different varieties. And if you're going to be a teacher, you need to choose which variety you're going to teach the kids who are under your care. And probably you will teach them a standard variety, right? You will teach them American English, maybe, or British English in a fairly standard form of the form that is used by essentially wealthy people, people who are successful, people who are from a certain area, who had the good fortune to be born into a certain kind of region or a certain kind of family. But it's always important to bear in mind that these varieties really aren't better than any other varieties, okay? There's nothing linguistically that makes the kind of English that I speak as a posh white man any better than the kind of English anyone else around the world speaks. What makes it different is that people like me are the people who have the power and the money. I mean, not literally me. If I had all of the power and the money, I would run things very differently. You get the general idea, right? Language is tied up with power. Language is tied up with status. And you need not to fall into the trap of thinking that a standard language is somehow inherently a good thing. Standard languages are shaped by their history. And we as linguists take a descriptive approach to the language. Again, this is really important, right? In your English class, you might get someone telling you, look, you ought to pronounce something this way and not that way. Hell, I might even do that myself if you come to my colloquium and you're preparing for the Staatsexamen, right? Because this is all part of the rite of passage that you have to go through as English teachers. But as linguists, as people interested in the language from a linguistic perspective, we're not interested in that. What we're interested in is how the language works. We want to get under its skin. So a standard language, how a standard language becomes a standard language is intrinsically tied up with power and influence and money. And one variety becomes standardized. But the process of standardization involves various different things happening. And again, we're going to come back to this later on in the course. The process of standardization involves people writing grammars, people writing dictionaries. right? People describing the language, actually, and codifying it. That's the technical term, codification. Codifying the language in the form that it should, that people think it then should be used, in a form that it can then be taught. And this process has consequences, particularly with regard to things that are relatively easy to influence by prescriptivists, such as spelling. We already see we're surrounded by people telling us how to spell. Not even people anymore. Computers tell us how to spell, right? If you go into Microsoft Word, your spell checker will constantly be highlighting things in green and red and blue and saying, you should be doing this differently. Right. We're really used to this. We're used to being told that we ought to conform to the standard. The influence of the standard, the influence of this standard language ideology is sometimes greater and sometimes lesser. And if you're interested in this kind of thing, I can recommend this book. This is a book called Fixing English, which is by Anne Curzon, which is about the effects of prescriptivism on language history. But let's get back to the key issues. Now, we're interested in English spelling. We're interested in how it got to be the way that it did. Well, in the early period, the Old and Middle English scribes, they took over the alphabet that they had, which was the alphabet that they'd inherited from the Romans, essentially, the Roman alphabet. And in the Old and Middle English periods, these guys couldn't give a monkey's what the spelling conventions were, right? They just wrote things, and hopefully it was roughly corresponding to the sound. So if you think about a psalm, the way of spelling psalm varies in the Old English text. We find S-E-A-L-M, we find S-E-L-M, S-A-L-M, S-P-A-L-M-E, S-P-H-A-L-M-E, and so on, right? These varieties are, the variation here is huge, right? And there was no centralized attempt to try and get people to write in the same way. This changes when we get to the end of the Middle English period. So from 1420 onwards, we get the influence of a body called the Chancery. And the Chancery is basically an institution that produces official documents. And before 1420 or so, the Chancery was mostly writing in Latin. Right, the official language would have been Latin, or in some cases a variety of French. But what happens in 1420 is that they switch to using Midlands English, a specific variety of the English language. Because these people were very influential, like I said, power and influence, this had effects on the way that the written language was shaped. All of this is linked to the rise of London as a trade and political centre. This is still, the spelling at this stage is still relatively flexible, but there are some fixed rules and already some archaisms being introduced. So if we take an English word like high, there is no consonant at the end of that word, okay? Believe me on that. There is a long vowel, a diphthong, high, but there is no consonant. There is definitely not a g, and there is definitely not a h, right? Otherwise it would be high g, right? And we don't say that. But why is it written? Well, this is one of the things that the Chancery introduced. The Chancery decided, oh, right, let's just put in these extra letters for no reason. And so ever since then, we've done it, right? Because of what some stupid people in the Chancery in the early 15th century decided that they were going to do. And this is where it all starts, right? This is where we start to get a written standard that diverges increasingly from the spoken language. In 1476, William Caxton sets up a printing press, also in London. This printing press is close to the Chancery, so these things are physically not too far apart. They would communicate with one another, they would interchange, people would be reproducing the same document over and over again. These documents would be distributed much more widely than was ever possible before. So from the end of the Middle English period, we have a massive change in the status of the written language. And it's also worth mentioning that the level of literacy at this point rises vastly as well. Right? Early English literacy would have been extremely low, tiny proportions of the population. Nowadays, it's almost universal. Right? Almost everyone can read and write, so much so that we take it for granted. Not so in the Old and Middle English periods, or even in the early modern period. From about 1600 onwards, we get this codification process going on, and then we get other important texts being written as well. So Shakespeare is writing around this time. We also get the King James Bible, which is the Bible that I showed you earlier on. The King James Bible, in some respects, actually looks quite modern. That's only because it, as a document, and the other documents that were being produced at that time, had a huge influence on the spelling of the language. But at the same time, something else was happening, something that the people who were trying to constrain the spelling of the language could not have foreseen. And that was something called the Great Vowel Shift. So from 1400 onwards, so crucially, before this stuff, before the printing press, before the chancery, the vowel system of English was already starting to change. And the Great Vowel Shift is something that we're going to cover in detail later in the course. But for now, basically what you can see, this is a diagram of what happens. What happens is that the long vowels in the language, specifically the long vowels, what happens to them is a bit like what happens to clothes in a washing machine. They go round, right? All of them go round. So in a word like, so let's take an example. In German, the word for name is Name. In Old English, the word for name was also Name. And this was relatively stable up until about 1400. From 1400 onwards, it starts to change. So the A vowel raises. It raises from being in the very low part of the vowel quadrilateral. It becomes higher and more front. So from A, it becomes E. So then we get name. And there are still people in Britain who speak like that. If you go to Yorkshire, the second part of the Great Vowel Shift never happened. They would still say name rather than the modern name. But you can see that this vowel has changed substantially. It's moved all the way around in the mouth. And this is the same with lots of other vowels, including the back vowels. The same thing happens. So the word for a boat, originally this would have been pronounced more like the German, boat, and then it would have gone, and again in Yorkshire you can still find this, but it's nowadays it has risen up, and then it would have gone to boat, and then also slightly diphthongized to this O that we have today. Right, it's a diphthong, right? O. And all of these words change places. Bait, beat, bite. The Great Vowel Shift is a huge mess. And we'll start to unpick how it works and what happens to it when we talk about early modern English. All you need to know for now is that it completely messed up the spelling of the language. It completely messed up the pronunciation of the language, and that wasn't reflected in the spelling, because the spelling had already been standardized by the time the Great Vowel Shift was complete. So this is why English spelling is so screwed up. This is one of the reasons why English spelling is screwed up. There are others. If you look at the convenient blue box in the bottom corner, this will tell you a few other things. For instance, people in the early modern period started to think that they were very, very clever. And they were especially clever if they could make something be spelled a little bit more like Latin. So let's take the word debt, right? In the Middle English period, the word debt was spelt D-E-T-T. Nothing wrong with that, right? That seems non-crazy as far as English spelling is concerned. What about this B? Why is there a B in the spelling? Well, it's certainly not because of the pronunciation, because I can tell you right now, in the English-speaking world, there are just no native speakers who would pronounce this debt or anything like that. This isn't a matter of prescriptivism, there just aren't any people who say that, right? So this B must have come from somewhere else, and it came from some very, very, very clever people in the early modern period deciding, let's make this word spelled more like Latin. So let's just stick a B in there, basically so that we can look smart, but also to stick a middle finger up to the future people who will be studying the English language and say, you know, screw you, we're better than you. And if you're angry, good, you should be. And borrowed words also often have weird spellings. As we'll see, English borrows a lot of words. So when we take a word like phoenix, we've got a PH corresponding to an F. A quota, we've got this QU written down that corresponds to a K and a W, but it isn't written CW. So these borrowings, these language contact influences also cause weirdness is in the English spelling system. And all of this stuff combines to make the English spelling system of today the horrible mess that it now is. What are we going to focus on in the rest of the course? Well, there are three big themes that both I and also the textbook will be picking up on throughout the rest of the course. First of all, we've got this question of internal versus external. Which aspects of the English language are influenced more by other languages outside English itself, and which of the changes that happen in English just happened on their own? Languages do change, we know that, so why did any given change happen? Can we evaluate this? Can we determine whether a change is internally or externally motivated? Another question we might ask is, as we will see next week, English and German are very, very closely related. Both of them are West Germanic languages. In terms of divergence, these languages are basically sisters. They're so close to one another. But why are they still so different? Right? What's happened to make them more different? And actually, English isn't just different from German. English is different from the other Germanic languages as well. So it's very, very different from Dutch. It's very, very different from, say, Icelandic, Norwegian, Danish, Swedish, you name it. English is really, really quite weird. And that particular weirdness is something that we'll explore. If you're particularly interested in this weirdness, you're warmly invited to my Antrittsvorlesung, my inaugural lecture as a professor here at the university, which will take place next Monday in the evening. So it's Monday at 6:45, and that will be at a quite basic level, so you don't need to worry about understanding that, but if you want to come along and find a little bit more about why English is so weird, and also a little bit more about the research that I do, then please do come along. Also, there'll be food and wine. Also, and unrelatedly, there'll be food and wine. And we'll be talking about both of these things, internal versus external factors in the history of English, also why English isn't more like the other Germanic languages. We'll also be talking in this course about the question of synthetic versus analytic, which I'll come back to in a second. English often doesn't look much like a Germanic language. This is what I've just said, right? So if you think about a Zahnarzt, right? It might not be a pleasant thought, right? But hold that thought for a second. Why is a Zahnarzt called a Zahnarzt, right? Because he is a doctor, or she is a doctor, should be gender neutral, or it is a doctor, or they are a doctor, that looks after your teeth, right? Tooth doctor. What could be simpler than that, right? And indeed, that's what all of the other Germanic languages do. So we've got German Zahnarzt, Dutch has got Tandarzt, Danish has Tøle, or something like that with not many consonants in it in the spoken form. And I'm not even going to try and pronounce the Swedish because it's probably weird. But each of them has the same form, right? You've got a word for tooth and you've got a word for doctor. And of course you bloody do, because this is a doctor who fixes your teeth. English, dentist. How untransparent, how ridiculous. Why do we have this word? Okay. Well, there are many reasons which we'll come back to. But it's just worth noting once again, English is behaving weirdly. And this weirdness is actually something that comes on as the language goes further in its history. So when we look at Old English, it actually looks a lot more like German. So we've given you an example. I've given you an example here of some Old English, right? Ich habe hier geholfen. And if you take the German equivalent of that, ich habe hier geholfen, this is basically the same, right? What's going on here? Old English looks a lot like German. And modern English, we've got I have helped her, right? This system has changed quite a lot. First of all, the Old English ich is a lot more like the German ich, rather than this modern English I, right? You've got the great vowel shift to thank for that, among other things. And then we've got this V in have. We've got what's happened to this GE at the beginning of the past participle. What's happened? Why isn't it got? Why doesn't it have an O in it? Why don't we have I have holpen or I have holped? And perhaps most interestingly of all, the word order is different, right? So in Old English, the object goes before the verb. Ihr, in German, geholfen, the verb. In Old English, here the object, geholfen, the verb, the past participle. And then in English, it's the other way around. Helped her, verb object, V-O. What happened? And this relates, of course, to our other two main themes. So the first theme is the internal versus external. And I've already touched on this. Internal change is a change that is linguistically motivated. And there are various reasons you might think of a language changing that don't have anything to do with any external factors, historical factors or language contact. Ease of articulation. If you try and pronounce an m before a p, it's actually very easy. It's easy because those two sounds are both produced at the front of the mouth. Okay, straightforward. What about before a k? It's a little bit harder in an articulatory sense because a m is at the front of the mouth and a k is at the back of the mouth. We're talking about the difference between a bilabial, m, and a velar, k. Often what happens is that sounds assimilate to one another basically to become easier to pronounce. Right. And this is not a change that anyone decided to make. These are just changes that happen in the history of language because over time, speakers will drift towards the most easy or the most convenient or the most expressive way of doing whatever they need to do. Never forget, of course, language isn't just out there floating in the ether. I always ask people, you know, I'm a linguist. I study the structure of language, but have any of you actually seen a language in the wild? Right? They're rare beasts, right? You don't see them very often, and that's because they live in our heads. And if they live in our heads, if they're part of us, then they need to work for us and they need to work with us. And when we understand the speaker's role in language change, we've made great progress. Prescriptivists often fight against language change. There are often people who really don't like this idea that languages just change. Okay? Just the other day, there is an article on the Daily Telegraph, which is a well-known right-wing newspaper in the British Isles, that was complaining about how the English language is going down the drain because people are using emojis too much. This is the kind of thing that people worry about. I think as a historical linguist, I would be inclined to tell those people to chill out. I think I would probably be inclined to tell those people to chill out anyway because life's too short to worry about whether people are using too many emojis or not. The point is prescriptivists don't like this kind of change. In fact, often they don't like any kind of change, but internal changes of this nature are often particularly unpopular in the English-speaking world. What's interesting is that English, unlike other languages, actually never had a tradition of a formal body being established to regulate the language. So in France, you've got the Académie Française, which is a body of very, very important people, mostly old white men, who look after the language. You've got in Italy, the Accademia della Crusca, which was founded for much the same reason, to preserve and to govern the language. Other languages have similar things. So we have institutions in Germany there are institutions that are sort of often regarded as the guardians of the language. So the Duden, for instance, though it's not quite as rigid as in places like France. England never had this. There was a proposal. So Jonathan Swift, the author of Gulliver's Travels, did propose to create an academy to regulate the English language, to regulate how it could change, to govern its future direction. But this never happened. And actually, it's probably a good thing that this never happened, because as these guys, as if there's one thing that history tells us about prescriptivism, is that it doesn't have the effect that it tries to have. And that, regardless of your value judgments about prescriptivism, is just an empirical fact. Right? If you're interested, again, I can recommend this book, Fixing English, because it tells you a lot about what people tried to do to the language. Now, this doesn't mean that prescriptivism didn't have an effect. It just didn't always have the effect that the prescriptivists themselves wanted it to have. And that is really the interesting thing. External change, then. External change contrasts with internal change in that it's brought about by language contact, also by things like historical need, issues of political or social identity. In relatively recent years, the English language has borrowed the term goji berry, along with our existing berries, such as cranberries, blueberries, blackberries, etc. Why do we need the word goji berry? Well, because we have goji berries, right? In previous generations, previous years, English speakers, if they didn't have access to goji berries, they would not necessarily have needed the word goji berry. In fact, they would have almost certainly thought that it was an entirely pointless word to have. Why would you have a word, for instance, for something like a computer, if you don't have computers? A word like to overshare, right? Here's a verb. This is the kind of word that you can imagine becoming particularly prevalent with the rise of social media and with the rise of certain types of society in which individual identity is emphasized very highly. We also get words like Brexit, which arise in a particular socio-historical context. If you go back as far as 2014, people weren't talking about Brexit because the concept was out there, but it was a fairly dim and distant possibility. Now, for better or for worse, my personal view is for worse, but there you go, it is very rapidly becoming a historical reality. So we need a word for it, and we have this particular word, Brexit. Now, maybe you can tell me, is it der, die, or das Brexit? Right, people have argued about this. Der, okay. Any other votes? No, interesting. Okay, der Brexit. I'll keep that in mind. Okay, so this may depend on geography, obviously, the external change. If there are big oceans between two languages, then obviously there isn't going to be as much in the way of contact. Right? If there are mountain ranges, there isn't going to be as much in the way of contact. In fact, small language communities can survive in mountain ranges with very distinct languages for many years. Look at the, for instance, Basque speakers in northern Spain. Look at the Romansh speakers in Switzerland. Right, look at the Swiss dialect speakers in Switzerland, for that matter. Right, people, little language customs can survive if they are geographically isolated enough. In the history of English, what's interesting is that there has been relatively little prescriptive opposition to change that has been driven externally. There was something called the Inkhorn controversy, and that we will talk about when we get onto the early modern English period. There was briefly a period in which prescriptivists railed against the use of foreign words. But that didn't end up lasting all that long, and it was, like many of these prescriptive efforts, very unsuccessful. Who influenced English then? Who or what? Well, here's a timeline. And broadly speaking, we can say in the very earliest phases of the language, particularly before English existed as a distinct entity, Latin would have been the language that this Germanic variety was in contact with. From 449, and we've got a cut-off point here, this is when English comes to the British Isles, from that day onwards it was in touch with Celtic. And of course it still is, but probably the most intense period of Celtic influence would have been shortly after the arrival of the Anglo-Saxons. A little bit later, we get Norse influence, influence from Scandinavians, and here we've got some examples of the kind of words that are borrowed. From 1066 onwards, 1066, another famous date in the history of England, this is when the Norman conquest happened, and we get William the Conqueror, we get a whole dynasty of kings who are at least as strongly associated with northern France as they are with the British Isles. From this same period onwards, Latin regains a lot of its force. In fact, in a way, it never really loses it, one way or another. We also, later, after from the Renaissance and during the Enlightenment, we get Greek influence, particularly in learned domains. And as soon as English starts spreading via the British Empire to all areas of the globe, we get what I've labelled here colonial influences. Obviously, there is no language called colonial. There are many, many different languages. This particular example, I picked you an example of a word, pajamas, which comes from Hindi-Urdu, in fact. But there are many, many, many words from around the world that English has borrowed as part of this imperial expansion phase. And English itself has changed in those areas, and it has had an impact on the indigenous local varieties too. So there's a lot going on here. And of course, we get up to the present day. We don't know what's going to happen next, right? How is the English language going to change? Who's going to be in contact with English in 1,000 years' time, even in 100 years' time? We don't know. But what one thing we can be pretty sure of is that English is going to keep on borrowing words, because English borrows words like crazy. If you look here we've got some figures for this. This just shows the biggest sources of words in the modern language. And this depends. What's interesting is how many borrowings as a proportion of the lexicon we look at actually depends on how broadly we conceive of the lexicon as a whole. If we only look at the most common 1,000 words, we find that 83% of those words are inherited from Old English. If we look, on the other hand, at the most common 10,000 words, then we find that only 32% of them are from Old English, and then a huge proportion are from French and Latin. Actually, French and Latin together account for more than half the vocabulary of English at this level. So the level of lexical borrowing into English has been enormous and can't be overstated. And we will explore some of the reasons for this as we go on. But we have this interesting contrast in English between the Old English vocabulary that is... most of the most common words in English do, in fact... originate in Old English, when you consider rare words, when you consider more learned words, then you get more Latin, you get more French, you also get more Greek as well. The discrepancy is quite amazing. People have occasionally tried to get rid of the loan words in English, but the thing is, if you got rid of all of the loan words in English, you wouldn't have very much left. So here is a petition that was started. Someone actually seriously proposed to the British government that after Brexit, we should, on our new blue passports, we should replace all of the French words, right? Because in English passport, we have a French motto. What's rather ironic about this is that if you look at the words that are used to form this petition, actually, the majority of them, or well, almost the majority, are in fact loan words. For everything that's underlined in blue on this slide is a loan word from French. Everything that's green is a loan word from another language. So, for instance, the word to vote is a loan word from Latin. Motto is an Italian word originally. The words take and there, very basic words, these are from Scandinavian, from Norse. The word British, as we've seen, is from Latin or Celtic. The word British itself, and all of the other language, all of the other words that we've got here, and actually, so that leaves only 35 of 67 words that are actually English words in origin or Germanic words in origin. And even some of those are pretty debatable. If we really want to consider European Union itself to be EU, to be an English word in any sense, this is quite a conservative count. But if you remove all of the French words from this petition, then you get something that is basically gibberish, which is all French words from the of new. The to leave the EU means to back. Of and whether and have as in England, for is French is an EU and has no on a UK. I, for one, do not want this to happen to my language. So it is fortunate from my perspective that this petition was politely ignored by the British government. But there you go. So we've got internal changes. We've got the great vowel shift. We've got consonant changes happening. And we've got epenthesis also happening in many dialects. I'm not going to dwell on this because we are short of time, but these are just some examples of internal changes that you can look at in more detail, and you can check the textbook if you want to find out more about this. The other crucial notion that I just want to touch on before we finish is the notion of synthetic versus analytic languages. Synthetic languages are languages in which grammatical relations and semantic features are marked by morphological endings rather than by word order. In an analytic language, grammatical relations and semantic features are marked by word order and grammatical words, and there is a lower morpheme to word ratio. So if we want to look at a fairly extreme synthetic language, we can look at Navajo, an indigenous language of North America, which has very, very long, very, very complex words, right, where all of the morphemes are just glued together in complex words. If you want to look at an analytic language, the prime example here would be Mandarin Chinese, where every different concept, every different logical relation is represented by a separate word, and there is very little in the way of morphology. English, we can see over its history, has become more analytic, and the question would be why? And this may, you might suspect already, this may relate to what we've just been discussing, language contact, the question of internal versus external motivation. But I will leave that as a sort of a hint for future weeks. So this summary, you can read for yourself when you come to revise for the exam, if not before. For you to do, I would like you to read the first two chapters of the textbook, which should hopefully mostly be refresher material and quite basic stuff. I've put a couple of chapters online as a taster so that before you buy the book, you can also try the book. Next time, we will be talking about the pre-Old English period, and that is it for today. I will see you next week.